Thanks, Mazaki. And first, I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation to speak here. It's great to be in Santa Barbara. And thanks to all of you for waking up on time for the 9 a.m. talk. Hopefully, I won't be putting you right back to sleep. So as was mentioned, I'm Michael Bretko from the University of Colorado Boulder. And I suppose my role here at this conference is to serve as sort of the token representative of the Fracton community to give you all a little bit of an update about what's going on inside the world of fractons. So specifically, in line with the broader theme of this conference, I'd like to talk about some recent pushes towards bringing fractons from fantasy land into the world of reality. This is going to be a fairly broad talk. I'm going to be talking about some of my own work as well as some work by other people. And throughout, I'm going to attempt to keep things at a pretty bird's eye perspective as to what's going on inside the field of fractons. Now, I know that some of you have heard about fractons before, either from me or other speakers. It's a topic that's received a lot of attention over the last couple of years. But I also know there's probably many of you in the audience who have not heard about fractons before. So the first thing that I want to do is to give a basic introduction to some of the basic concepts of fractons and what they do and why they're interesting. So what exactly do I mean by a fracton? So the short answer to that is that a fracton is a new type of emergent quasi-particle excitation found in various condensed matter contexts. And unlike other weird types of quasi-particles, like anions, etc., what distinguishes fractons from normal particles is that they have a set of severe restrictions on their dynamics. Specifically, a fracton is a quasi-particle which does not have the ability to move by itself. If you consider a single isolated fracton, there's no operator which can take a single fracton and move it to some other location in the system. Nevertheless, that doesn't mean that the dynamics of a fracton system is completely trivial, because fractons can move when they combine to form certain bound states. For example, in the simplest types of models, when a fracton combines with an oppositely charged fracton to form a dipolar bound state, this resulting composite object is then free to move around the system. And this type of mobility structure is enforced by a new type of conservation law which emerges in fracton systems in the form of conservation of higher charge moments. The most common example of this is the conservation of dipole moment, which is found in a variety of fracton models. And it's fairly easy to see that if you have conservation of dipole moment, then it's impossible for a single charge to move around, because if a single charge moves, it changes the total dipole moment of the system. So this is ruled out by the conservation laws. Okay, so that's sort of what fractons do, but why is this interesting? So it turns out that the restricted mobility of fractons leads to a wide variety of unusual phenomena. For example, as I'm going to talk about today, fracton systems are generically very slow to reach thermal equilibrium, and they can exhibit non-ergodic behavior even without the presence of any disorder. Another unusual feature is that certain fracton systems can even exhibit gravitational behavior in the sense of a universal attractive force between fractons that's mediated through an emergent geometry. Unfortunately, I'm not going to have time to talk about gravitational behavior in fracton systems today, but for people who are interested in that, I can refer them to the literature. People have also proposed ways of harnessing the immobility of fractons for the purposes of quantum information storage. And at the other end of things, at the theoretical level, the study of fractons is interesting for all of the deep connections which it has been able to draw between a wide variety of other topics in physics, ranging from elasticity theory to holography to higher order topological insulators, which you heard a bit about from Taylor Hughes the other day. So this all seems nice and cute from the theoretical perspective, but the natural next question to ask is, does this have anything to do with actual physical systems? And in order to begin to answer that question, it's useful to take a sort of semi-historical perspective. The first place where fractons were encountered was in the context of certain exactly solvable spin models exhibiting quantum spin liquid behavior. There's a very old model due to Claudio Shimon. And there's the famous Haas code model, which has this characteristic fractal structure. There's a wide array of other models, such as the X-cube model. And these models served as a very nice proof of principle that the fracton phenomenon exists. However, they're also extremely complicated, and they tend to involve a lot of beyond nearest neighbor multi-spin interactions. For example, Haas code has some 9-spin interactions in it, which make it very unlikely that this type of spin model is ever going to be realized as is in an actual material. Now, this is not to say that fractons can't be realized in spin systems. I'm actually going to talk today about a little bit of progress in that direction. But in terms of these original spin models, I would rate them very much at the fantasy end of the fantasy to reality meter. So the next major advance in the study of fractons came with the realization that fractons occur as the topological lattice defects of ordinary two-dimensional solids. Specifically, if you look at the dislocations and disclination defects of 2D crystals, you find that they exactly exhibit the sort of mobility constraints that I just mentioned. So these are, in some sense, the paradigmatic example of fracton excitations. However, even in this case, there's some technical difficulties. So the fractons in this type of system, which are the disclinations, they're definitely very real, but they're also extremely energetically costly. So they're not really accessible here to us in the present day, because it's not really technologically feasible to isolate an individual one of these fractons and study its individual properties. More recently, there have also been various proposals for approximate realizations of fracton physics. For example, if you look in the very simple context of holes doped into an icing antiferromagnet background, what you'll find is that it's very hard for a single hole to move around the system because it ends up creating these spin misalignments, but it's easy for two holes to come together and have that dipolar bound state move around the system. So this is a sort of realization of fracton physics. But if you study this problem in detail, what you find is that the fracton behavior breaks down at sixth order in perturbation theory. So this is only an approximate realization of fractons. It's somewhere halfway in between being alive and dead. And the reason why I'm going through all these examples is to sort of convey the point that the field of fractons is on the verge of reality. We have a lot of almost realizations, but some final pushes are going to be necessary to bring this firmly into reality. And that's sort of how I want to structure the rest of this talk, is talking about some recent pushes towards bringing fractons into closer contact with the real world. So I thought for the rest of this talk, it would be useful to first recall what has brought all of us this week to sunny Santa Barbara. This is information which is stolen directly from the KITP website. Now, according to the organizers, we are here this week to understand real-world realizations of interacting topological phases by answering three specific questions. Can spin liquids be realized in experiments, and what are their smoking gun signatures? What are the footprints of topological matter at finite temperature? And to what extent can one mimic topological physics in classical frameworks, like electric circuits? Now, when I saw these questions, I got very excited because I realized that over the course of the past year and a half or so, I've been working on exactly all three of these questions in the context of fractons. So I thought I would structure the rest of my talk in terms of brief answers to each of these three questions for fracton systems. Specifically, can spin liquids with fracton excitations be realized in experiments, and what are their smoking gun signatures? What are the signatures of fracton phases at finite temperature? And to what extent can one mimic the mobility restrictions of fractons in classical frameworks like electric circuits? So the first topic, which I'm going to treat, which is a very important frontier in this field, is can fractons be realized in an actual spin liquid candidate material, and how would you know if you found it? So as I mentioned before, there's a wide variety of exactly solvable spin liquid models for fractons, such as the Shimon model, Haas code, and the X cube. And all of these were very useful for building up intuition about fractons, but they also involve beyond nearest neighbor multi-spin interactions, which make it very unlikely that they're going to be realized as is in an actual material candidate. So a piece of progress came a little bit later due to Kevin Slagle, who's in the audience, and Young-Baek Kim, where they showed that fracton behavior can occur even in a model which features only nearest neighbor two-spin interactions. Now, to the best of my knowledge, this model does not point to a specific material candidate just yet, but it's at least a very important proof of principle to show that fractons do not intrinsically require all of these complicated multi-spin interactions. There was yet another piece of progress, which occurred just a few months ago, which I found very exciting, due to a group from Okinawa, several of whom are in the audience here, where they found that fractons can occur in a spin ice type model on the breathing pyrochlore lattice. And the breathing part just means there's some anisotropy here between the two different tetrahedra in this system. And this is a simple two-spin nearest neighbor model on the pyrochlore lattice, but it adds in the special extra ingredient of Jaworzynski-Maria interactions. And what they showed was that by adding in these Gelsinski-Maria interactions, you can drive what would otherwise be a conventional spin-ice phase into one of these fractonic spin-ice phases. Furthermore, this model was directly motivated by certain ytterbium-based pyrochloric compounds. And so this model has now identified a new class of materials which have the possibility of realizing fracton spin-ice physics. Now, also, once again, to the best of my knowledge, there hasn't been material in this class which has definitively been demonstrated to exhibit this type of physics, but this model gives me reason to be very optimistic about this. Now, so the search continues for better spin liquid candidates for fractons, but how would you actually know if you had a spin liquid which had fracton behavior? And so we want to come up with some experimental diagnostics which we can use to detect the presence of fractons. And today, specifically, I want to talk about two of them. One of them is pinch point singularities, which are a very unambiguous smoking gun signature for certain gapless fracton phases. And then in the next section, I'm going to talk a little bit about the thermodynamic behavior of fractons, such as their glassy dynamics and localization. There are various other experimental metrics which you might think of for fracton systems. There are certain correlation functions which you could look at, which unfortunately are non-local and very hard to measure. There are certain fracton systems which have a quantized thermal Hall conductance, although that's only for a very special class of fracton systems, and it's far from generic. I also included the dynamic spin structure factor here because I personally think there's probably going to be some signature of fractons in the dynamic spin structure factor, but no one has ever calculated that, so that remains an important open question. For now, however, let's focus in on the example of pinch point singularities. So for those of you who have studied spin liquids in the past, you'll be aware that pinch point singularities are an important tool in the study of an older type of spin liquid, specifically the pyrochlore spin ice materials, such as the titanates, which are described by an emergent U1 gauge theory, essentially an emergent Coulomb phase with emergent magnetic monopoles and all that sort of thing. And pinch point singularities are a signature in the spin-spin correlation function, which is a direct diagnostic of this emergent gauge structure. Specifically, if you look at the spin-spin correlation function, it maps onto a correlator of the emergent electric field, or the emergent magnetic field, depending on your definitions. And if you look at the electric field correlators, certain components of this correlator exhibit a characteristic angular singularity, which looks a little bit like this on the right here. So this correlation function, it will change four times as you go around the origin here. And this type of pinch point singularity can and has been readily observed through the use of neutron scattering. So here's some neutron scattering data, I believe, on holmium titanate, where you can very clearly see the presence of these pinch point singularities at certain points in the Brillouin zone using polarized neutron scattering. So we now want to apply the same technique to the study of fractons. But the important question here is, what type of gate structure naturally emerges in a fracton spin ice? And the answer is, instead of a conventional vector gauge theory, the type of gauge theory that emerges is actually a symmetric tensor gauge theory. The simplest example of this is essentially the tensor generalization of Maxwell theory, where the gauge potential and electric field and magnetic field, instead of vector quantities, they're actually going to be rank 2 symmetric tensor quantities. And this theory can be characterized in various ways. It has a whole set of tensor Maxwell equations. But by far the most important part about this theory is its generalized Gauss's law, which features a double divergence acting on the electric tensor, giving you the charge. And what's important about this generalized Gauss's law is that it leads immediately to two separate conservation laws. It's easy to check, based on this definition of charge, that it obeys both conservation of charge and also conservation of dipole moment, which I took as one of the defining characteristics of a fracton system. And as a reminder, the combination of these two conservation laws immediately leads to the phenomenology of single particles can't move, but dipolar bound states can move. So we now want to apply this same technique to the tensor gauge theories. Once again, the spin-spin correlators are going to map onto these emergent electric field correlators, which has some complicated form. But if you look at certain key components of this electric field correlator, what you'll find is that there's once again a characteristic angular singularity, but now it's a sine 4 theta behavior as opposed to a sine 2 theta behavior, which indicates that the pinch point structure of this theory is going to look very different from conventional spin-ice pinch points. On the left is a sort of pinch point which you would expect in conventional spin-ice materials, which has this twofold symmetry pattern. And on the right are the sort of pinch points which you expect to see in a fracton spin-ice material, which now is characterized by a fourfold symmetry. And indeed, it was shown by a group of people here that in this model on the breathing pyrochlore lattice, they verified numerically that if you look at these correlation functions, you find precisely these types of fourfold pinch points. So the hope is that in the coming years, experimentalists may be able to look at some further candidate materials in this class, and we'll be able to look out for these types of pinch points, which serve as a very clear indication of gapless fracton phases. Now, so that's one experimental diagnostic of fracton behavior, but unfortunately, it doesn't apply to all types of fracton models. There are other gapped fracton models which do not have these sorts of pinch point singularities. So for those models, we want to try and find some more general diagnostics. And to that end, it's useful to look at what fractons do at finite temperature. So you might naively think that because a fracton can't move, that it should just be trivially localized at all temperatures. But that's a little bit too quick, because while a fracton can't move by itself, it can move by absorbing an extra dipole. And at finite temperature, there's going to be a bunch of thermally excited dipoles running around the system, and a fracton can then become delocalized by interacting with this thermal bath of dipoles. An analysis of this form was conducted by Prem et al., where they showed that the interaction of a fracton with a thermally excited bath of dipoles will eventually cause the system to relax and reach thermal equilibrium, where the fracton has delocalized across the entire system. However, this relaxation to equilibrium occurs logarithmically slowly. This is a manifestation of glassy dynamics, or sometimes referred to as asymptotic many-body localization, without the need for any sort of disorder. So this is a completely translationally invariant system. Furthermore, there are certain special examples of fracton models, like Haas code, where the relaxation time is not only exponential, but actually super exponential in the inverse temperature. So at low temperatures, the relaxation of time of the system can be ridiculously long, longer than the age of the universe, if you like. So for all practical intents and purposes, the system will forever remember its initial conditions. So slightly later on, another investigation of fracton dynamics took place in the context of one-dimensional systems subject to random unitary time evolution. So in this work, which was led by Shreya Pai, who's in the audience, we investigated a sort of minimal model for fracton dynamics in one dimension, which was a fracton system evolving according to a random unitary circuit, where the only constraint on this random unitary circuit was that it obeys fracton conservation laws. So in this particular minimal model, we've chosen three site gates, which corresponds essentially to nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor interactions. And the reason for that is that if you look at only nearest neighbor interactions, you'll find that the dynamics is completely trivial. So you have to go out to at least next nearest neighbor interactions in order to get any non-trivial dynamics whatsoever. And when we investigated the time evolution of this system, what we found is that this minimal model features perfect localization of fractons, in that if you initialize a fracton at some particular location, then out to any time that's accessible in the simulations, the fracton remains localized around its original position. So the system maintains a perfect memory of how it started out. Now, we now know that this localization can be disrupted by even longer range interactions. So if you include something like third nearest neighbor interactions, the system will eventually relax to equilibrium and go back to the previous story of glassy dynamics. But to the extent that you're in a system which only has nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor interactions, the system will actually exhibit perfect localization. Okay, so now that we've established that fractons can exhibit a lot of interesting non-ergodic features, what sort of platforms can be used for testing this non-ergodic physics? Well, one important recent development along this direction has been the realization There's an intimate connection between conservation of dipole moment and the application of a linear potential. And so this connection really is just as simple as the dipole moment is a linear function of x, and the potential here is also a linear function of x. So if you apply a strong enough linear potential, you can enforce the effective conservation of dipole moment and thereby get non-ergodic behavior. And there's some theoretical support for this idea out of Caltech, where they found that a strong linear potential can indeed lead to non-ergodic behavior. There's even some very recent experimental results which indicate that a weak linear potential can already lead to some slow subdiffusive behavior. And there's the hope that by applying stronger linear potentials, we may eventually be able to get into the truly non-ergodic regime characterized by fracton behavior. Along this same line of thinking, if you can get fracton behavior from an external linear potential, then why not fracton behavior from an internal linear potential? So in a paper, which we just put out a couple of days ago, Shreya Pai and I showed that if you look at one-dimensional confining models, such as lattice gauge theories, there's actually a nice mapping from these confining models onto fracton Hamiltonians, at least within certain parameter regimes, where the fractons become localized by the linear potential associated with this semi-infinite string attached to the fracton. And this coincides well with some previously known facts about confinement. Confining models are known to exhibit various types of non-ergodic behavior, such as quantum many-body scars. So confining models also may represent a useful frontier in the coming years for studying the behavior of fracton systems. Okay, so now I want to get to the last part of the talk, which is sort of a cool down. I know that I've thrown a lot of facts and figures at you throughout this talk about fracton systems. In the last part of the talk, I just want to play some fun games about how to realize fractons in classical electric circuits. So I thought I might as well call this section Fun with Fractons. So it was realized a few years back that the physics of topological insulators can be mimicked in ordinary classical electric circuits, specifically AC circuits. And if you construct a lattice of capacitors and inductors, what you'll find is that they can give rise, in certain parameter regimes, to topological admittance bands, which host robust topologically protected edge modes. And so the question then occurred to me, can you do the same thing for simulating fracton physics? Can you mimic fracton behavior using these sorts of electric circuits? And the answer turns out to be yes. And the special extra ingredient which you need to add is an electrical transformer. So a transformer is an electrical circuit component which is primarily used for the purpose of transforming a voltage, transforming a current at one voltage on one side to a current at a different voltage flowing through this other wire. But there's more to these transformers than meets the eye, in the sense that there's, in an ideal transformer, there's a nice relationship between the ratio of the currents, where the ratio of the currents is also given by the ratio of the number of windings on the two sides. So if you choose this correctly, such that you have n windings on this side, and you have n windings on this side, but in the opposite orientation, you can construct a perfect counterflow of charge, where you have current I flowing this direction on this side, and current minus I, well, flowing in the opposite direction on that side. And then you can then use this perfect counterflow to design a circuit geometry which features the perfect conservation of dipole moment. So I'm not going to go into detail into this circuit schematic here, but the main point is that I have some array, a one-dimensional array of capacitors here, and they are connected using a bunch of transformers, chosen in such a way that for every right-flowing current, there's a corresponding left-flowing current, in such a way that the total dipole moment of the system, as defined here, always remains constant. Q is the charge on the capacitors. Sorry. Yeah, this is just a one-dimensional lattice of capacitors, and these are the charge and position of each of these capacitors. And it turns out there's a very simple diagnostic that we can apply here to make sure that the circuit is actually doing what we want it to be doing. If you initialize the system with voltage only across one of the capacitors and zero voltage across all the rest of the capacitors, and you let the system relax to equilibrium, what you'll find is that at the end of the day, at late times, there'll be this characteristic linearly growing voltage pattern across the system. And as you all know by now, linear functions are closely connected with dipole moment. And this linear functional form of the equilibrium voltage pattern turns out to be a direct signature of conservation of dipole moment in this system. So that's just a way of checking that we actually implemented the circuit correctly and that it does indeed conserve dipole moment. Now, of course, this is all just a start, and there's lots of things that can be done moving into the future. For example, can the quantum fracton models be directly simulated, for example, using superconducting quantum circuits? It also would be interesting to think about what sort of other physical platforms could be used for mimicking the behavior of fractons. For example, it's been shown that certain types of topological phases can be realized using mechanical systems. I believe this hand is in the audience somewhere. It's also been shown that topological phases can be realized in photonic systems. So maybe we could realize fractons in mechanical or photonic systems. I also was starting to think a little bit about hydraulics, since there's a natural analogy between electric circuits and mechanical systems. So there's also an analogy between electric circuits and hydraulic systems. So why not get into the land of topological hydraulics? So yes, I'll finish a couple minutes early, I think. So I want to summarize my talk today by I'm hoping that I gave you the impression that fractons are a field which is just on the cusp of reality. We're kind of almost there. There's a bunch of sort of realizations of fracton physics, but there's room for improvement here. We would like, say, for example, a nice candidate fracton spin liquid material where we could go in and study the individual properties of fractons. And there's various diagnostics which you can use for detecting fractons, such as their pinch point singularities. And there are also various new platforms which we can use for trying to engineer fracton behavior and bring fractons from being an object which are purely fantasy to being objects which you can hold in the palm of your hand. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention.
So now the session, yeah.
I just had a very naive question about the thermalization initially. So I assume that that these defects are stable up until some particular energy scale, right? So it's not like, so this infinite memory that it retains, I assume that happens up until some energy scale.
No, so that's actually at infinite temperature.
So, okay. But surely there's like an energy scale with the formation of the fracton itself.
That's true, yeah.
Right, so presumably above that energy scale, you wouldn't retain memory.
So no, because even in that case, I mean, if you nucleate you can't nucleate individual fractons out of the vacuum. So because of this sort of conservation of dipole moment, you can only generate fractons in fours. And so it's not possible for that fracton to just directly decay. Even if you're above the energy scale for its creation, it's not going to decay. So it's going to interact with a thermal bath of thermally excited dipoles. But at least for a certain class of models, that localization remains perfect, even above the energy scale associated with fracton creation.
Michael, so I'm not an expert on this at all, but so from some of the pictures that I've seen in some of the talks, when people, for instance, describe fractons, they put them on the vertices of either the tetrahedron, like in the case of Haas code, or maybe a square, and then the argument is that if you want to move them apart, you can, but you have to move, let's say, all four of them.
Yes.
And you achieve this by sort of inserting certain excitations in between, or acting with certain operators
right.
in between.
Mm-hmm.
And so that operation, does it cost energy?
Yes.
So in that sense, you can move them.
So they can move, but a fracton can only move at the cost of creating an extra dipole in the system. So let's just focus on the simplest models for now. When a fracton moves, it creates a dipole. And importantly, it keeps creating a dipole at each step of its motion. So it's not like, if you pay the energy cost to create a dipole, you can set the fracton into permanent motion. You'd have to keep putting in energy at each step. So you have to put in the energy cost to create a dipole at each step of the motion.
Right. Now, people also talk about linons or linions, I don't know how you pronounce this, right, where the motion is restricted to one dimension.
Yeah.
How does this relate to any aspects of your talk?
Yes, so those are all part of the broader fracton family. So There's particles which can move, say, along only one dimension or only along a two-dimensional subspace or anything that's less than the dimension of the physical system that you're working in. And those are governed by the same sort of conservation laws that I talked about here. So fractons can be enforced by something like conservation of dipole moment. There's a similar conservation law which can enforce one-dimensional behavior. It involves a vector charge with a cross product. It's something sort of like an angular moment conservation law, which forces these one-dimensional charges to move only along a line. But it's a very similar principle which governs those as well.
And if they do move along the line, does it still cost energy? You still have to create dipoles?
So they can move freely. They can move freely along one line, but it costs energy to move them in the perpendicular directions. So essentially, they behave like normal particles in one direction, but they behave like fractons in the other direction.
Thinking of other ways of diagnosing the fractons, since you mentioned this difference between local and uniform or collective properties, would it make sense to look for a susceptibility that at Q equals zero, so for the uniform part is large, and the local part instead is, when you sum over all Qs, instead is small?
That's a good question. I expect that's also related to these various correlation function diagnostics that I was talking about today. Where the pinch point singularities, they have some singularity at Q equals zero, and I expect that other types of correlation functions will also have singularities near Q equals zero, which will show up in various types of susceptibilities. But I honestly don't know which type of susceptibility will be the best to look at yet. Yeah. But that's an important question.
I was thinking also that a sort of dichotomy between the Q equals zero singularity and instead the locally something that is inert, sort of, because you mentioned so locally it's zero, let's say, or close, and Q equals zero instead of zero.
I see what you mean, but I don't think there's anything firmly established in that direction, and I'm not sure. Yeah, I have any other comments I can give on that at the present time.
Could you please clarify in the continuum mechanics context that you mentioned at the beginning, the fractons correspond to the dislocation or to the disclinations?
Disclinations. So in the elasticity context, let me just go back to the beginning really quickly. In the elasticity context, the disclinations are the fractons, and the dislocations actually correspond to the dipoles. And so you can show that a dislocation is just a bound state of two equal and opposite disclinations.
If I put a bunch of colloids on a sphere, then I have a fluid of 12 fractons.
Yes.
And they can move with the system captures essentially most of the features that you.
It essentially should, yeah. So if you had some lattice of it's a very interesting question. If you had say some lattice of fractons, like 12 disclinations around a sphere. There's some subtleties that are going to be associated with that, since fracton behavior is a little bit difficult to put onto curved space. But if you say you made your sphere big enough to eliminate effects due to the curvature of the sphere, you should see certain characteristic features of that fracton system. For example, it shouldn't be possible to sort of just uniformly shift the whole lattice. So you should see the absence, I think, of certain zero modes of that system.
Electric circuit setup, can you see localized fractons?
What's that?
In the electric circuit setup.
So, yeah, that's a good question. So in the electric circuit setup, no, not at the present time. I mean, the question was, can we see actually localized fractons? And the answer is basically no. So this is not really working with quantized fractons at all. So this is actually a continuum charge distribution, which has been designed by hand to obey conservation of dipole moment. Now, I think it would be interesting to ask, say you took some superconducting quantum circuit components, so you took quantum dots, there's a way where you could actually could directly simulate discrete fractons, in which case I would expect that you could observe fracton localization. But here, we're just working with a smushy continuum of fracton charge. And so there's not really a way to see anything localized about individual fractons.
I had the same question.
Okay.
So maybe it's not going closer to reality, but you mentioned that there was an emergent geometry somewhat like gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Is something that's something you can say a few words about?
Sure, absolutely. So I talked a little bit, here, about how fracton systems tend to be described by emergent tensor gauge theories, as you know. And so there's a natural question to ask where fracton systems are described by symmetric tensor gauge theories, and gravitational systems also are described by a type of rank two symmetric tensor gauge theory in the form of Einstein gravity with its rank two symmetric tensor metric. And so a natural question to ask is there any similarity in the phenomenology between those two types of systems? And it turns out to be a very nice connection where this type of system exhibits local conservation of dipole moment. And if you look at a gravitational system, it exhibits local conservation of center of mass. And it's actually a fun exercise to show that conservation law is one of the crucial aspects leading to the universal attraction of a gravitational theory. And so essentially, this conservation law, local conservation of dipole moment, ends up leading directly to gravitational behavior. Essentially, the idea is that a fracton can't move by itself, but if you have two identical fractons, they can pull on each other or push on each other in such a way that their dipole moment is conserved. And they tend to pull on each other more strongly when they're close together. And so just by the locality of the system, you end up with the fractons moving faster when they're close together, which gives you an effective attraction between the fractons.
When you're saying close together, so we are talking about which range? Because we are talking here with dipole, and are we talking about dipole-dipole type of interactions, or
short range?
Kind of,
So in many fracton systems, for example, this one that I wrote down here, it turns out that the gravitational physics is purely short range. You can also cook up other models where the gravitational attraction is long range, but in the simplest types of models, the gravitational attraction is short range, and so there's some interesting physics where there's a short range attraction but also a long range repulsion in these systems, and so whether fractons attract or repel each other depends very strongly on what energy scale or distance scale you're looking at.
I have a question that's not sure whether it's related or not. You mentioned this whole doped anti-ferromagnetism,
mm-hmm.
and I'm thinking instead of thinking an easing spin model, but just think about the Fermion-Hubbard model.
Yeah.
We know that if it's a single hole doping, you get Nagaoka ferromagnetism.
Right.
And I believe if you have two holes bound together, you can also prove the ground state is a ferromagnetic state.
Okay.
Does it help?
So that's a good question. So this is essentially a statement, it's somewhat a non-equilibrium statement. So when I mentioned the hole-doped anti-ferromagnet, the statement was that it's very hard for an individual hole to move around the system, but is actually possible if you look at six-order imperturbation theory. And so if you, for a certain range of times, it looks like this individual hole is localized like a fracton, but after a certain time scale, the fracton's going to delocalize and go to whatever the appropriate lowest energy state is, which, as you mentioned, should be something ferromagnetic. And so that's something I haven't thought about, but presumably, as the fracton becomes more delocalized, then the system will go into that ferromagnetic state. But this isn't a statement about the actual lowest energy state. It's sort of an out-of-equilibrium situation.
So you mentioned these emergent tensor gauge theories,
mm-hmm.
and then there are, discrete models, like, X cube model, et cetera,
right.
Fractons. So is it clear, like, you know, is it a study that what is from the point of view of the RG theory, renormalization group theory, that how, you know, these discrete models, you know, may flow to these, you know, kind of continuum model?
There has been a study of the relationship between the continuum models and also these discrete lattice gauge theories. So for, let me go to this. So at least some of these discrete spin models, we know how to get them from the continuum models via the Higgs mechanism. So say you take this U1 lattice gauge theory that I wrote down with the tensor Maxwell fields. You put that on a lattice and then you Higgs it use the Higgs mechanism to go from a U1 gauge theory down to a Z2 gauge theory, you can get, it's known at least how to get certain types of these discrete fractal models. I won't say all of them, but the X-cube model, for example, it essentially corresponds to a type of Z2 tensor gauge theory.
Thank you.
Michael, could you say a few words about the, if I remember correctly, it's the sub-extensive topological degeneracy of the ground state, and how, you know, allegedly this is something that's not common in topological quantum field theories.
Right. So if you look at many of these discrete models, instead of normal topologically ordered phases, like the toric code where there's a finite degeneracy that depends on the topology of the system, you get, in this case, a sub-extensive degeneracy, which grows with the system size, but in a sub-extensive way. And so that cannot be captured in a usual topological quantum field theory. There have been ways of getting around that. For example, Kevin Slagle, who's in the audience, developed a set of field theories which can be applied to these sorts of fracton systems. And so these can't be captured in the ordinary language of TQFT, but there are field theoretic approaches which do capture that sub-extensive degeneracy.
And when you talk about the degeneracy, I mean, isn't the ground state absence of any fractons? Because right? you could say you could take four of them and just,
that's right,
you know, annihilate them. So really, we're not talking about the degeneracy of the ground state, but the degeneracy of a given energy state?
No, no. So
is it a certain number of fractons?
It is the degeneracy of the ground state. So even in the state without any fractons whatsoever, there's a huge degeneracy there. So say in some of these models like the X-cube, you have fractons which can't move at all, and in this particular model you have dipoles which can only move along a two-dimensional plane. And so then you can get between ground states by taking, say, a pair of dipoles and wrapping them around the system. But there's different inequivalent ways of wrapping them around the system. You can wrap them around the system in this plane or wrap them around the system in this plane. And those are inequivalent ground states. And so the end result, the resulting state in either case, has no fractons in it, but it still corresponds to two different degenerate ground states.
Other questions? Maybe I want to ask a question. So you mentioned about possible realization using linear potential.
Yes.
So I suppose if you have linear potential, then the energy is proportional to charge times the coordinate, which is conserved. But if I have charged particle and just apply electric field, then I realize linear potential. But in such system, in reality, somehow dissipation occurs, and
So
you want to avoid dissipation somehow?
Well, or? So in that case, I mean, when you have a real electric charge and a real electric field, it's going to accelerate and simultaneously emit radiation.
Yeah.
And so in that case, you're coupled to a gapless to gapless modes. Mm. And so whenever you're coupled to gapless modes, this physics is probably not going to survive. So even, we'd have to worry about coupling to phonons and things like that. But yeah, it's a very important physical question. Is a normal particle in an electric field is going to accelerate, but that's only because it also has the ability to emit extra photons. And in this case, we're assuming that's not the case. It's not coupled to anything like that.
Any other questions? If not, thanks to the speaker again.